Okay, I think we'll call the meeting to order, even if we don't quite have a quorum, and we'll start to get hard and hard to get people to places they have to be on time, so. But we'll start. Now, this is obviously an issue that's been very important to the governor. It's clearly very important also to people on this committee. I think we at one point have stated to people testifying before us that this may be the friendliest place you find in the legislature. So doesn't mean that everything will work out all right.
Yeah.
let me say that as I say that, that's not saying very much. But let's go from here. Okay.
Madam Chair, my name is Gopal Khanna for the record. I'm the VIO for the state of Minnesota. I'm here to represent OET, Office of Enterprise Technology, and we appreciate you calling us and look forward to sharing our program with you. I have a couple of my colleagues here with me. John Lally to my right, he's the Director of Planning and Portfolio Management. I also have Chris Bruce, who is the Chief Information Security Officer. What we'll be doing today is covering the governor's initiative. That was the main interest that you had for us to come and talk about that, as well as our funding model and our progress on the security side. Madam Chair, members, ever since the Office of Enterprise Technology was established as a standalone agency, our focus has pretty much been in three major areas. One is to continuously find ways to optimize the existing IT assets across the enterprise. Second has been to define the future. We recognize fully well that we have a lot of risks and exposures, and our real challenge before us is to build a secure and modernize our digital infrastructure for the state. And the third one is to create transition strategies and initiatives that will help us take us there. What we have here today is a PowerPoint presentation that we walk through with you today to cover all of these areas. And I'd like to call upon my associate Chris Ducey to join John Lally over here to do this joint presentation. And upon that presentation, I'll come back again to answer any questions. Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you very much. Mr. Ducey.
Madam Chair and members, my name is John Lally, and I have nothing to do with technology. I'm planning director for OET, and I'm trying to figure out how to make this thing work right now. What we're going to do is, I hope is what your expectation is to go through three things. First of all, a little bit of an overview about the agency. Secondly, talk about the governor's major initiatives involving OET, data center consolidation and electronic licensing, and OET funding and budget reductions, the base level activity on the final budget this year. And we'll be happy at any point in the presentation to answer any questions you may have. First of all, Chris Boothie, our Chief Information Security Officer, and I have been looking at what the major roles of OET are, and our mission statement is deceptively simple. It's to provide leadership and services, improving government through the effective use of information technology. It only took us about a week to work through all the different words on this mission statement to get it exactly right. And the main thing that is to understand that this mission represents a major change in perspective for state government, because in the past, the individual agency missions around technology sometimes collided and occasionally were not even in communication. One of the things that has happened with the appointment of Gopal Khanna as a cabinet level CIO is we begin to see some coordination and some coming together of the strategies for the entire executive branch and for the state as a whole, as far as that goes. What we're trying to do at OET is to be in a position where we continue to exercise leadership at that strategic level, as well as at the level of standards and architecture and portfolio management, but also be the primary provider of IT services to state government. We use the phrase the provider of choice because we want it to be a choice. We want to get the business on the services side of our organization. because we're good, not because we're here. The service areas that we have are leadership, which includes IT policy and enterprise planning and governance. And this is our, all of the oversight functions that we have, includes at the enterprise level of that, and security. And I know you've had a continuing interest in information security in Minnesota, and that's why Chris is up here. If you have questions about security, he's far more able to answer those than I am. The second area that we have is in the area of compliance and standards, which is where our architecture, products, and standards, as you know, we've engaged in the awarding of some master contracts for technologies that are open to local government units and school districts and others to achieve the best possible price through standardization and through volume buying. We also have security compliance and audit as a significant part of the compliance and standards piece. Again, Chris can address questions like that. And issues of portfolio management and project oversight. Our third service level area is what we call marketplace services, and this is the organization in large measure that started out as what you will remember was called Intertechnologies Group. It's computing services and consulting services, project management, web services, and data center management, hosting of applications, storage of data. Like any other technology business, we compete for business. We operate on the basis of the revenues that are provided to us for the services that we provide. And finally, we have a third technology service area, the fourth service level, is the utility services, where we are designated as the Center for Telecommunications Services, Voice, Video, and Data for state and local government, higher education, and K-12, and run utility services like enterprise email on behalf of the entire state. So that's kind of the business we're in. That's what we're trying to accomplish.
You know, John, I don't want to interrupt too much, but this provider of choice concept is kind of interesting. Of course, does that really work with what the OET's mandate for, you know, having to agree to everything is? And in a sense, should it work? One of the things that bothers me a little bit is that when you give a lot of people who don't know what they're doing a lot of choice, they're kind of open to the worst drug salesman that kind of like pharmaceutical sales or something like that. So, you know, I'm obviously a high believer in choice, but I have a little problem believing in it when the combination of stuff you have to look at is so complicated and the snake oil salesmen are so prevalent.
Madam Chair, it's an interesting debate to have about whether choice is appropriate here. There's a couple things that factored into our decision to move in that direction. One is reality. There are other alternatives for agencies. They can go out to the private sector, and some of them do for certain services. The second is the reality that we are not masters of all the areas that we administer. And so we have to depend on supplemental sources of expertise, whether they're in the agency or in the private sector, to meet those needs. And third is there's an advantage to having to be competitive if you want to stay sharp. If you're a monopoly, if there's no competition, you can start to let things fly, and we don't want to do that. So we believe that we can be competitive in many of the areas that we operate. There are some other areas that we probably shouldn't even try, and for the others, we'll see. We address the issue of whether the agencies are making the right choices through the leadership aspects of what we do, by establishing architecture and standards, by giving them advice, by establishing a framework in the master planning process, so they have something to help guide them towards decisions. Most of the time, the decisions are good decisions. Maybe not always the ones we would like them to make, but they're reasonable decisions. Occasionally, they're not, like any human endeavor.
Okay.
I just have one question. Because a lot of the information that is acquired by the state is essentially mandated, If we are outsourcing it, how private is the information then? If it goes outside of people that, say, the state actually has control over?
Madam Chair and Representative, there's a couple different ways to answer that. Most of the data about people stays within state control. And the fact that the computers may be running someplace else or the network runs someplace else doesn't mean we don't have control over it. We take data privacy very seriously. There are a lot of security issues. Chris can address those if you'd like to talk about how we do encryption and other things to protect it. But the other part of it is in any contractual obligations that a company might incur to the state, they also take on the accountability for the same laws that affect us about data privacy and data sharing. And so we have not, at least I'm not aware of any major violations of that at a contractual level. We've had situations where employees of the state and employees of individual companies have gone digging around in information they had no right to be in. And in most cases, the audit trails for those systems detect that and report that, and then the employees are usually discharged or disciplined at least. It's much the same way that right now the legislature, for example, I know has a very strong desire to keep private the information on your policy proposals and the things that you're trying to accomplish. But your communication with the outside world is over the internet, which is not under your control. But your messages are encrypted, and your files are protected through different levels of security, so that that really doesn't affect the transport of your confidential information. I don't know, Chris, you know more about this than I do.
Chris, Mr. Busey.
Madam Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Christopher Busey. I'm the Chief Information Security Officer for the state of Minnesota. To answer the question, though, the fact of the matter is that in today's world, more and more computer operations are being outsourced or intertwined with the outside world. So it's incumbent on us as the executive branch of government to make sure that we really clearly define the policies and the standards and have that same litmus test for the private sector that would have our data as we would have for that data internally, and make sure that we enforce those policies and standards through the contractual arrangements that we have established for those organizations. So that's really the way it needs to be done. They have to have the same controls that we would have internally, or better. We have to make sure that that actually happens through contracts, and then we need a process to actually monitor it. In the Enterprise Security Program, we do have a compliance function, and one of the express purposes of our function is actually third-party oversight.
Madam Chairman and members, in every other year, we sit down and look at what our agency strategies are going to be. This is within the context of the governor's objectives and the master plan for IT for the state. One of those is related to the discussion we just had to transform OET to be a provider of choice rather than a monopoly. Second is to rebuild our customer-facing processes and channels of communication, which is a means to that end, but it's also an obligation on our part to be more responsive to their needs and not to be in a situation where we come into an organization and say, here's the solution to your problem before we know what their problem is. So it involves basic things like communications and good customer service as a routine thing rather than an exception. We need to improve our financial system. One of the limitations that we hope is going to be addressed with the new PetMap system is making it more convenient and easy for people to understand this labyrinthic rate system that we have, which is very complicated because we have a multitude of services, and we want our financial system to be transparent and understandable to the customers so that they understand when they're getting good value for their money, for the taxpayer's money, if you will, and that our services are competitive in quality and level of service. We also want to advance the limited number of new high-priority enterprise service initiatives. We have decided we cannot function if we attempt to be all things to all people. We cannot be expert in all fields. We do not have the volume. We do not have the size. We do not have all the skill sets. So we'll be identifying where our role in state government leads us into these utility and shared service functions where we can be leveraged across the executive branch and all of state government in some cases. And otherwise, it'll be services that are in demand by our customers that we can do and do well. And then finally, we need to manage both our internal and external IT governance better. Governance is the process of working with your stakeholders and customers to make decisions and to see that you are tracking performance, you are managing the portfolio of IT assets, and that is our responsibility as well, both within OET and within the executive branch. The governor has advanced, and you will have in your budget book, two separate initiatives of significant strategic importance. Both of these come out of the master plan, which was initially delivered 2 years ago, and you should have gotten just the update very recently, which is essentially as strategic plan should be. It's a refinement, not a radical change from 2 years ago. The first is around data center consolidation, which has been near and dear to our hearts for a number of years. The importance of this is hard to overstate. Data centers are the heart of information management. Our data centers are where we store the information that we have on our citizens, on our clients, on businesses, on criminals, on everybody that we do. We have information, and that's stored in data centers. And some of the examples of the things that are really significant to our operation, 9/11 operations, criminal records, welfare benefits, tax records, school grants, voter records, vendor payments, payroll, all of those things are contained in data centers that are either owned by the state or are leased by the state in various places. But because they grew up independently of any central design, we have many too many data centers that are difficult to consolidate and coordinate and are not consistent with the good standards that we have to protect that kind of information. We've known that we have a problem here for a number of years, and we know that if we don't protect those data centers and the information and the applications that run on the computers in those data centers, we can't protect the integrity of state operations. It's as simple as that. The state is too dependent on information and information technology to allow this just to drift. We engaged one of the major companies in the business of data center assessment and planning to do a completely independent study to validate our perceptions about data centers. If you will recall, in the Drive to Excellence, one of the programs that was looked at was data center consolidation. It provided some independent assessment of our data center conditions to match up with what we did, but we still lacked specific details, the kind of details that make it possible to make a significant change. So we engaged the company, and for the last year they've been looking at the executive branch data centers, and the conclusions were not encouraging. They believe, as we do, that the state needs a new centralized data center for those mission-critical IT components because our current situation, we have too much risk, we have too much waste, and we're too ineffective. Now, this is a hard judgment to make on your own operations, but we think it had to be said, and we had to be honest about identifying the situation. And I'm going to take just a moment to go through those, but I'll try to do it at a non-technical level so that we're working off a common data base, but please interrupt me if you have questions. The first issue is we have too much risk. Industry standards for data centers that are holding the kind of information that we have and running the kind of applications that we have for state government are typically in what's called a Tier 3 data center. It has redundant power, redundant data feeds, so your chances of it going down are much limited. There are actually four tiers of data centers from Tier 1 through Tier 4. Tier 4 would be a data center to run, for example, an airline reservation system or a national defense system. Tier 3 is a step below that. There isn't a Tier 3 data center in the state of Minnesota, in anywhere in state government. Most of our data centers are Tier 1, and some, unfortunately too many, don't even get good enough to be in the tier system. They would be what we call Tier 0. Most of them are retrofitted office space. We don't have a lot of buildings that were designed to be data centers with all of the power and environmental conditioning and security and everything else that goes with it. So we have data centers that are converted closets that are office space. They lack good power control. Just their office space that's functioning in the guise of a data center. As a result, there are unsafe environments for those. There's no fire control. Many of them run the risk of water damage from everything from backup sewers to leaky ceilings. And we've had a number of examples of that in recent years where there's been damage to data centers because of that. There's a high risk of service interruption, which could be anything from somebody with a backhoe cutting into a fiber optic line to a tree falling on a power line. Those are the most common kinds of interruptions, and they can be devastating to a data center. There are also a number of data centers where the physical security to protect against intrusion or against damage inadvertent or otherwise, or cybersecurity, where that needs to be beefed up significantly.
Madam Chair, can I interrupt? Yeah. Mr. Lally, could you talk a little bit more about the Tier 1, 2, or 3 standards for data centers? I know that having managed IT network people to some degree in the past, if you just listen to what they say that you need, you end up with probably at least 40% more than what you need in order to accomplish your mission. And so I guess I wonder if you could provide a little more background on what those are and what kind of level we should be aiming at.
Madam Chairman, Representative Winkler, I agree. I can't imagine a data center manager that wouldn't love to have a Tier 4 data center at their disposal. And if you conjure up the vision of a Tier 4 data center, you think of a high-security building with these humming generators and ranks and ranks and ranks of disk drives and computers and so on. And we have some that look like that. But a Tier 4 data center has multiple, in the case of a Tier 4 data center, it'll have three separate power feeds that are all independent from different places on the power grid. And they'll have backup generators for their backup generators. They will have power conditioning that could make your data center feel like Antarctica to keep the processors cool. And again, that for most businesses, that's overkill. And for many of the applications in state government, it would be overkill, except that it's cheaper. You have to take this on faith, or I can bring somebody in and explain it. It is cheaper to build a Tier 3 data center than to build a combination of Tier 2, which we do have many applications that need, and Tier 3. The construction doesn't make any sense to do that. Tier 2 is more what I think a standard data center would look like. Inter Technologies Group data center, or ETS now, on top of the Centennial Office Building is probably a Tier 2 data center. The new data center in the Human Services Building is at that level. A Tier 1 data center typically has one power feed, so if the power grid goes down, they're done. Their backup generator may be enough to allow for an orderly shutdown of their servers, but it won't allow it for them to keep operating. They'll have one data feed coming in, so that if that fiber optic cable is cut, you're done until they can repair a fiber optic cable, which can take a long time. Many of our data centers didn't even get up to that level. We've got pictures of power strips and plugged into power strips, plugged into power strips. You can see some of them on the screen in front of you. That's a nightmare from a data center standpoint. When I was Chief Information Officer at the Department of Human Services a few years ago, one of our primary data centers didn't even have racks in it. You had boxes stacked on top of each other and power strips. It was a nightmare. The major router connecting us to the internet was under a leaky air conditioning unit. This is not good stuff. And while most of our major systems aren't in that situation, a lot of systems that affect citizens, that affect state government, are, in fact. And that's what's important, that we understand that for somebody who needs a system, the size of the system doesn't matter. If it's important to their business or to their life and it goes down, it's a problem, and it doesn't matter where it happens. All of the things that we've identified here exist far beyond the tolerance level and have for a number of years. But like other aspects of the infrastructure, it's very easy because of the high capital costs to ignore those in your normal life cycle determinations. And like highways and bridges and a lot of other things, it's only when you get to a crisis point that somebody says, good Lord, we can't allow this to continue because there's too much at risk. That is the situation we're in right now.
Madam Chair, so Mr. Lally, you're suggesting a Tier 3 level data center, which I could you just describe a little bit more about what that, or maybe you will, but what the kind of components of that are?
Sure. Somebody has a cell phone on that's humming and making all kinds of noise. So if you have a cell phone, would you not only silence it, but actually turn it off because it interferes with our system, which is probably some inadequacy in the wiring that if we were an executive agency, we could blame on OET. Okay.
Madam Chair, well, unfortunately, we don't have setups that put in the executive agency still on.
Okay.
There's an organization, Madam Chair, Representative Winter, called the Uptime Foundation, I think it's called, that sets these standards for different data centers. And they're all functions of security, power, environmental controls, physical plant characteristics, and so on. As I said, most of the state data centers are Tier 2. The good ones are Tier 2 data centers. The assessment that we made when we first started looking at this about 3 years ago was that we did not need Tier 4, but our really critical major applications had to have a Tier 3. And once we had reached that conclusion, which was validated by the consultant that we brought in, then it was an easy step. The next step is to put all of our primary operating systems in a Tier 3 data center. Tier 2 is a step down simply because it doesn't have the backup systems and the redundancy and the capacity issues. Now, one of the problems we've had is many of our data systems have been running at capacity for a long time, which increases the drain on the hardware and makes it more likely to fail. And so we're trying to build all of these things into the new data center.
Okay. Representative Mason, I think?
Madam Chair. Sir, this is my first year on this committee, so I have a lot of learning to do. My question is, what you're telling me sounds quite appalling, and
it's not your fault, it's all our fault.
And we do have your agency now that is supposed to be doing the oversight. But in any event, why do you think some of these things happening? Is it lack of, we didn't have the expertise previously, or lack of money, or how were some of these things allowed to happen?
What can I do it? Start at that answer, and I hope I don't know what we'll see this year, is that when we go through a budgeting surface and we're setting targets and everybody is looking at, do we want to support computers or do we want to support elderly people or sick children or something like that, they make their decision really quickly. And let me say something about the discussions that we did with information systems last year as we were doing it. I think they came in and, I don't know if it was maps or something like that. It says, take $70 million to do maps properly, and if we need to patch it each year, you know, this is the small amount of money that it will take to keep doing that, which gets you nothing except dealing with the security and keeping it lumping it along. What do you think we did? So we're trying to hope that we don't do it again this year, but when we're in a worse budget situation. But anyway, I'll let John give the more informed answer.
Madam Chair, nothing would make me happier than to lay the entire blame of this at the feet of the legislature, but that really wouldn't be fair. Part of it is just the growth of technology has been so incredible over the past few years. It's grown faster than our ability to stay ahead of it in planning and in development. Part of it is the financial issues that come with trying to maintain and build and operate services and systems at the same time. And it usually is maintenance that suffers. Part of it is the lack for many years of central guidance around architecture and standards, which is why agencies made their best individual decisions for their services and their systems, but they're incompatible with the next agency down the road. We see this in critical areas like security, where the lack of standards, more than anything else, is what causes problems with this. And as you'll see in a couple of minutes when I start talking about the diversity that we have in these data centers, we have an absolutely unmanageable mishmash of technology that don't interact anywhere near as well as they should. It's not negligence. It's the way things happen when you don't have enough money to go around, and or it's, in some cases it's when the money that is spent without consideration of the environment as a whole that people are working in. And that's what our role is in government, is to try to provide that context, the standards, the architecture, the portfolio management, to support an integrated approach to managing technology. The state spends, depending on how you count the dollars, somewhere between $400 and $600 million a year on technology. And that's a significant part of the state's budget. And it's only been in the recent years there's been an attempt to really coordinate that spending at any significant level. So it is a need that needs to be addressed. And it's always, as Representative Tom said, it's addressed in the context of larger needs that the legislature and the governor have to deal with.
Actually, I think I put my first bill in on this subject trying to do it in 1976. So, see how effective I've been. Yeah.
Madam Chair, committee members. One thing that's very interesting is that when I came over to the Enterprise Technology Office, one of the last things I got to do before I actually left the Legislative Auditor's Office is address that very question from the security standpoint. And at that time, the Audit Commission held a hearing to talk about all of these bad security reviews that were happening all over the place. And they wanted us to kind of take these disparate security reviews that always have these bad results and put it together and try and tell them, what is it that we really need to know here? And I think the way we summarized it for Senator Rest at that time was that really the problem that we have is we're trying to do everything everywhere without sufficient planning and leadership. And I think just looking at it at that very level and saying that that complexity is our enemy in today's world, and that when we're trying to do so many things on so many different fronts, it's very hard to be successful. So that's one of the biggest challenges that we're having today with the Enterprise Security Program, is that when you look at all these data centers and all these disparate processes everywhere, there simply is not enough money in the world to throw at it to fix the problem. So that with initiatives like data center consolidation, for example, it's so much more than physical buildings. It's simplifying the environment as well. So that if we want to do intrusion detection and all the things that people expect us to do nowadays, we can do it once and we can do it well, rather than trying to do it 70 different times across 70 different environments.
I think Representative Schiffmeyer.
Great, thank you, Madam Chair. And it's encouraging to hear this, you know, some of the comments that you've made. But I do want to mention, though, having worked on this very hard in the Secretary of State office, we took a 2%, 5%, 15% cut, real cut, not a reduction of the increase, and still were able to make significant changes in our IT department, in our database storage, in our warehousing, and developing, and security, and many things like that, and really made it a critical part of the way we did things and redoing business processes. So certainly, that is important, but I always would have liked in those earlier days to have had an Office of Enterprise Technology to be a resource. I think we could have gotten there faster, easier, and would have really appreciated having that pooled resources where you have somebody that is in state government that can help you to do some of those things. They weren't there in the beginning, and I'm glad to see you're there now. But I think there's when you have so many silos going around with so many variations, just putting that all together and having that knowledge isn't necessarily easy. I think OET provides a great resource to us getting there, but I do think we need to be careful because change isn't always change for the better. Sometimes it's change. And I want to be sure that when we're spending these dollars and taking these next steps and activities, whether it's here or MAPS or many of the other things we're taking a look at, that we really have a well-thought-out plan first and make sure that we don't have opportunities to make mistakes here. We're in these times where it needs to be done right the first time. So I'm hoping that as we go through some of this, I think some specificity. We are a committee that maybe has a little bit broader background in some of these things, and I'd like to hear specifically the difference between Tier 2 and Tier 3 in a little more specific way rather than the goal-oriented. We expect them to do this or that or some of that, but you know, what does Tier 2 do that Tier 3 doesn't, and be very specific about it. I think we can handle it, and would appreciate those kinds of things. I think it might keep things up a bit, too.
They do have a lot that they have to get through right now, so we might have them come back with some of those, or have them come back with some of that in writing, or have them come back with...
And Chair, what I'll do, I'll send you, I'm not going to send you the full tier spec, which is about this thick, but I will send you the summary of the tier system.
anyone who asks something, you should send them the full. No, I'm just joking. Okay.
We will.
Summary.
Representative Winkler and.
Okay.
And also Representative Kiffmeyer has evidence and interest in that. We'll get you the real information, the real bill on that. And at one point,
we would like the summary. That would.
I will do that now, sure. I want to make one thing clear. I'm not sure that I did. Most agencies do a good job of managing their own technology. I mean, there are incidents of inadequacy and incidents of superior management. Most of them do a good job, most of the time. The trouble is we don't do it consistently, and we don't do it in ways that give us the greatest economy and the consistency of standards and the interoperability of data. And that's what our goal is, to try to manage at a state level to accomplish these things. It doesn't matter if we're all going off in different directions if we have absolute independence. We don't in state government. We have limited resources. We have to make the most of them, and that requires alignment. So that's what we're trying to do, is to narrow down that path that the agencies are going through so that we can get the best dollar value as well as the best quality out of our information system.
Representative Holder.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to that point, I like your term alignment. What state policies require that alignment, and to what degree are we having all these agencies off spending money hither and yon in different systems, and when this alignment appears to me the most economical and have the longest duration as far as serving the needs of the state? And then number two, kind of in that same realm, is do you as an agency compete against the private sector for these systems and various agencies? Or, I don't want to mandate Office of Technology does it all by themselves and they do everything and they're the best and never have any competition. But on the other hand, it seems like we've got to rein in all this process of stopping wherever for whatever and not talking to each other and ending up with a bunch of different systems. So.
Madam Chair, Representative Holbert, I wish we were that good that we could exercise that kind of responsibility. I think what is most effective for us is that leadership function where we establish the standards and the architecture and the guidance, where we take advantage of what is already in law in Chapter 16E that explains a multitude of responsibilities that the Office of Enterprise Technology and the state CIO have in governor's executive orders. What that has led us to do is create an environment where we're working much better with other agencies than was the situation in the past. We've collaborated on the state's IT master plan. We've begun to develop an information portfolio which has information on systems and assets and directions and strategies. We've created models for planning that enable us to look across agencies and see how these align. So that environmental piece is getting better, is getting much better. And we're also recognizing that it isn't always doing it centrally that's best. What you want is the best of breed, and if we can offer that, we should. And if we can't, we need to give agencies enough freedom to follow through on that.
And Madam Chair, is there a provision in state law that requires them to get a bid from you?
No. Well, I'll have to let him do it. Then I'll talk about 16E.
Madam Chair, Representative Holbert, actually, from a bidding standpoint, we work with agencies, and our goal is to help them do the planning to get to the decision point. in fact, as I mentioned before, the resources are not there for us to do that on a universal basis. So we try to publish standards and directions from everything from project management standards to architectural standards that the agencies can follow, and we try to exercise an element of reasonable oversight over the biggest projects that are out there, because that's where the most risk is. Complexity and the size and the cost of a project is directly related to its likelihood of failure.
Madam Chair, committee member, one concrete example that explains John's concept is for the state as a whole, one of the real issues that we have from a security perspective is dealing with the constant barrage of vulnerabilities. We need an automated way to assess our systems and to fix the problems before they were exploited by hackers and people that are trying to use the state systems for identity theft and that kind of stuff. So we have the authority in law. It's part of Chapter 16E to set the statewide policies and standards. We also have the authority in law to actually to build and run the state's cybersecurity systems. So what we did in that particular case is we worked with all of our partner agencies through the state's Information Security Council, and it was important for us to really make sure we understood the agency's requirements. But we built and deployed one comprehensive vulnerability and threat management system. We also put forth a policy for all of government, and we ran it through the governance process that we talked about a month ago when I testified. So by working collectively with the agencies and using our policy setting authority and the authority we have in law, we built and deployed one system that's probably one of the best solutions that's out there today, and it's used by all of government. And the beauty of that situation is individually, agencies simply don't have the manpower, they don't have the money to get into this business that they absolutely have to be in. So that's one really good example. And the payback for us as a government, if you read in the papers, for example, about the big computer vulnerability that happened with the Moundsdew Public Schools, we had 3,500 computers that were impacted, and the school district, from a technology perspective, was shut down for several weeks. But collectively, being able to do this for the government as a whole, when problems like this come about, we can find those problems, we can fix them, we can communicate with the whole government with lightning speed to kind of plug these holes before we get into that situation where we have massive downtime for government. So that's one example where this has worked very well. We have a lot of other examples that we need to get into on a similar front, but I thought it would help for you to see like one real-world example of how this works.
Okay. Just in general, 16E is the only statute that I know by name. I can come up with it in my sleep, I think, or something like that. And my belief, which is obviously too simplistic, is that, well, maybe when we get to the next slide, I should say it, the too much waste, is that if you rigorously look at how to apply every word of 16E that's available, none of that would have happened. Now, you know, as I said, it's probably too simplistic, but there's a lot of control for originally the Department of Administration and now OET to just stop a system in its tracks, to not allow any appropriation to be spent and so forth. But the question is whether it's used or not is separate. Anyway, you can contradict anything I say, because I know it's only half right, so... Okay.
Madam Chair, I wouldn't dream of contradicting you. but the reality, of course, is the authority is only part of it. We do have to exercise the authority. We exercise it on the basis of priorities to try to do what we can as best we can within the limits we have. The independent experts, which are, again, the consultants we hired from the outside to be ruthlessly honest with us, predict that there are going to be a number of major data center failures in the coming 3 years, and this is based on a lot of the evaluation of the age and condition of the servers. We have what we call a refresh rate, which is how frequently your computers are replaced or refreshed. A 5-year life cycle for a server is pushing it a little bit. Most organizations replace their servers in critical situations on Fort. Half of the servers in state government are more than 5 years old. And that's, again, because the cost of replacing them incrementally has exceeded the financial ability of the agency. Because of that, and because of the physical condition and electrical capacity and so on, and the growth in the use of these servers and data servers, they predict failures that will include loss of service. And if the wrong systems go down, if 9/11 goes down, for example, and life is threatened by a failure of a responder to get there, that's pretty serious stuff. Productivity downtime is there, fines, cost of retrieving data, and the cost of rebuilding the data capacity in the system. If you try to think what would happen if the individual intersect system went down in April, what would be the consequence of it? Unfortunately, these kinds of things don't tend to happen when we want them to. They happen at the worst possible time. And these are the things that they're warning us about, and these are not us making up doom and gloom stories. These are coming from people who make their living advising major corporations and other entities about the risks and the conditions of their data centers. We talked about waste, and waste is an issue here. There are currently dozens of data centers scattered across 32 buildings in state government. Now, these data centers, in drive-by excellence, I think there was a number of 67 or 68 or something like that. That included closets where servers were put. We're talking about rooms that are dedicated space for data center. Together, that data center space occupies 69,000 square feet of space that the state is paying for every year, year after year. Some of it's in state-owned buildings, some of it's in leased space. According to our experts who looked at this, if you look at the number of servers and the capacity we have, through a combination of co-location, in other words, putting them in the same place, consolidation, which is taking advantage of the ability to share the space more, the capacity more efficiently, and virtualization, moving from a bunch of boxes to fewer but larger boxes, we could reduce that to about 20,000 square feet of space. Unfortunately, there aren't a lot of blobs of space that we can pick up and move someplace else where we need them, because they're usually buried in the middle of an agency. But it is a significant cost, and along with it goes the cost of energy for heating and cooling and power that is over the capacity that is needed. We have probably five times as many different kinds of servers in state government, and this is not an insignificant issue. It really complicates maintenance and replacement of these servers. We have 85 different operating systems, and it's not just a matter of it being a Unix server or a Windows server or a Macintosh server or something like that. There's so many different flavors and ages and generations of operating systems controlling those servers, 85 of them as a matter of fact. Some of them are custom made, many of them are obsolete, some are no longer supported by the vendor, so if it goes down, our staff or an agency staff have to get into that operating system and begin to do base level coding, which is not fun when you're talking about operating systems. And a lot of these facilities are situated so they serve one customer, but they can't have the flexibility to help if something else goes down next door. We lack the ability to share those resources and share that capacity. And unfortunately, we're not as effective as we should be, either to deliver the value we should be or the quality we should. Agencies are managing data centers with resources that would be much better spent focusing on the use of the technology to serve their customers. We are duplicating the management of data centers across state government. And because we don't...
Madam Chair, just a quick question. Does any of this, in your judgment, have to do with procurement in the first place? In other words, is there anything that we are either doing or not doing that is interfering with your ability at the procurement stage to avoid some of these problems?
Madam Chair, Representative Simon, certainly adhering to standards will help. And in the last 3 or 4 years, our information standards and resources group has put together statewide contracts limiting the number and variety of operating systems and hardware servers and desktop units which eliminates a lot of the problems of these incompatible systems, because now you're operating in an environment where your maintenance is simplified, your operating system updates are much easier to do. You get rid of all the incompatibility, but that's been a fairly recent occurrence. It's been, I think, 2.5 years that those have been in place. So if you've got an average life, not average life expectancy, we're over the life expectancy, but an average lifetime of 5 years, half of that stuff should have been replaced by now, but in fact, much less has been replaced. Over time, that will help address that unquestionably, as well as increase the savings due to that, which right now runs into the millions of visits.
Madam Chair, Mr. Lilly, is there anything that you can think of that we can do to help other than the money issue, which...
Madam Chair, Representative Simon, I think Representative Kahn said it well. There's a lot already within the law that we have the ability to do. We are trying to work in conjunction with other levels of government to expand the benefits of that sort of thing. That addresses the hardware and kind of the off-the-shelf software components of it, so we're dealing with a much less diverse environment. But it will take time to replace that. It's in the applications and the databases and the custom programming where a lot of the incompatibilities come back to haunt us. We literally have applications that we can't move to another platform because they're so out of date. I was told once that the average life expectancy of a private sector business application is 7 to 8 years. We have many applications in state government that are a quarter of a century old or older. And it's just difficult when you get into that multi-generational support.
Madam Chair, committee members, it may be stating the obvious, but to answer your question, I think really taking a hard look at the data center consolidation initiative and supporting it, that's what this is all about.
One of the things that distresses us a little bit in the atmosphere we're in terms of budgeting is that we get all these lines about the significant costs and significant savings that we should see. I think we're going to need to see those quantified in some way, even if they're just best guesses. I think we're going to need to see a platform laid out. We spend this now and we do this, and what's the timeline and what rental spaces are we going to be able to close or convert, and that sort of issue. I think we'd also like, Excipio was the company that did the, I think we'd like to see what, I think we can't see the whole thing because of security issues,
Madam
but we'd
Chair,
like to see part of that third-party assessment.
And we'd be happy to make Excipio available to you from the committee
okay.
if you'd like. As you said, some of the information in there, because it contains information on areas of sensitivity and vulnerability, we can't share, but there's other stuff certainly at the summary level that we can, and we'll be happy to provide that. They're still in the process right now of wrapping up that assessment, which looks at some of the options that we have, and
right.
hoping that will be available.
And that will give us a kind of return on investment mm-hmm. model that we can be talking about.
Yeah. The options we've considered to deal with this, and this is not...
Representative Mason, just wanted to make one comment. Some of us just came out of public safety where we had a testifier who had been dealing with some of our law enforcement agencies, and he said he was amazed at the backwardness or the lack of technology that they had. But item one, he had worked for IBM, and two, that he did say that we really should consider giving... upgrading the technology of these agencies.
Well, you have spoken about Trinidad, it's real.
Madam Chair, in putting together the strategic plan, the master plan 2 years ago, we were trying to look at what are the best ways we can approach this to get impact quickly and to address some of the issues we have with our data centers. And we looked at four options then, and we looked at those same options again now and when we come to you with the data center proposal. So one option is always an option. Unfortunately, we've followed it too many times in the past, which is not to do anything at all. And that risk is just enormous. The second option is to continue as we have and fix issues on a site-by-site basis. And that means we upgrade all of these data centers, try to make them as modern and functional as we can within the limitations of the space they're in and the conditions of the buildings and so on. And as we hope to be able to show you when we finish the analysis, the cost for that is extraordinarily high. It's absolutely the wrong way to go. You'd be making huge investments in buildings, much of them in lease space, that would never benefit us the way we need to have these things happen. The third option would be to essentially delay building the new data center, make some selective fixes to the best of the data centers that exist within state government, and there are some good Tier 2 data centers. But essentially, it postpones addressing the worst situation. It makes a significant additional investment in a few of them, and it doesn't really accomplish the outcomes we want. The final option is the one that we selected, the one that the advisor selected, and the one the governor ultimately selected, was to consolidate data centers by co-locating the resources that are in those state data centers into a couple of data centers, one of them be a primary operating data center for the state, and others to be serving as backup to those data centers, which is one of the issues for those systems. So very few of them have a backup plan. They don't have a tested data recovery or systems recovery strategy. There's no business continuation plan that can be executed. They may have ideas about it, but it hasn't been tested. And that's another one of Chris's areas if you want to talk about that. But it really is critical to us to have that backup capability. By co-locating, by leasing the space, which allows us to get into the space faster than if we go through the normal sequence of 4 or 5 years of design and bonding and building, we can address the immediate issues and do it in a manner that keeps the price down from addressing them piecemeal. This is why we chose this strategy, and these numbers, they're better than estimates. They're not guesses. Some of them are calculated fairly precisely, but there is a factor around them that is a variability depending on the choices we make. Essentially, our current operating cost for data centers is almost $10 million, $9.9 million a year. That's what it costs to run the data centers. Now, we're not talking about supporting applications or any of that stuff. This is just running the data centers and providing power and cooling and everything else to them. To reduce the risk by investing in the current space, that cost jumps up to $28 million a year because it's going to cost us $58 million in capital expenditures to bring them up to standard. That's going after the top tier of probably 7 or 8 or 9 of those data centers. And at $28 million a year is a substantial increase in the cost to do this, amortizing it out. Leasing a co-location site, which is a building with all the power and environmental controls and security in it, and placing all of our server assets in that while providing some backup and security in our old data centers, is instead going to be about a $14.85 million a year increase, cost, which is an increase on an annual basis of about $5 million a year. But for that $5 million, we are moving from Tier 0, 1, or 2 spaces without backup into Tier 3 spaces with adequate provision for all of the support they need and providing the backup capabilities, which is a significant improvement. The crux of all of our decision-making has been around what can we do, what can we do quickly, and what can we do at a level of economy that makes it feasible to undertake. The governor's initiative, in our opinion, makes the best investment with the resources we already have at our hands. It leverages those existing investments in the best data centers to use them as backup spaces, which, by the way, if your main data center is a Tier 3 data center, it does not necessarily follow that your backup data center has to also be a Tier 3. That can easily be Tier 2 space because you're not dealing with the same level of criticality. And we can manage the risk in a more responsive fashion. When we're done, we will have stronger disaster recovery capabilities, a greatly reduced element of risk just from having that Tier 3 capability, higher levels of physical security for our data centers. Our operating systems will be more stable, and through the process of consolidation and virtualization, they'll have greater interoperability in the future. We'll be in an industry standard facility, which is easier to maintain over time. We will be upgrading or modernizing the equipment to get out of this current situation of having half of our stuff obsolete. And we will have easy maintenance and operations in the future. And as a side benefit that has significant economic benefits, the provision of this higher efficiency data center will save money through energy efficiency over the current operations. Again, it's going to take time till we get that migration completed, but those are very real benefits from the environmentally friendly solutions that we're looking to now. Okay. Just to give you an idea of what this means, and I'm not going to bore you by going through line by line with this, but if you just look at the relationship between the column-headed current and the column-headed future, you're going to see some of the reductions in complexity in our environment that are going to make it more reliable and more secure and more economical. Just going down in numbers of servers, the makes of servers, the getting away from having outdated servers, reducing operating systems, and all the other things that are part of this, makes for a much more stable environment, an easier to maintain environment, an environment that you can build on for the future instead of constantly adding perhaps unnecessary capacity because you don't have the ability to share those resources.
Well, all that missing from this is dollar signs attached to it, or at least an estimate at the bottom. Kind of to that point, going back to the slide, the co-locate and lease, and you talk about a five-year cost per year of approximately $5 million. I mean, at what point in extrapolating this out, I understand that this conversion, of course, you're going to have lots of capital costs and conversion costs, et cetera, and we're pretty light on the cost-saving figures relative to energy and space and staff. I mean, at what point does the state realize measurable savings in the out years from being able to have maintenance and replacement schedules? And I mean, I'm assuming that there's a very long-term benefit to this consolidation. And does the benefit always accrue to the agency, or at some point is it going to accrue to your department?
Madam Chair, Representative Fulbert, I'm sorry. Very, very good questions, all of them. The initial savings are not going to be there because the reinvestment will suck all of that up. The reality is that, and we questioned this with the consultant, because it seemed counterintuitive that you reduce the number of physical servers, you reduce the cost of maintaining those servers. And, in fact, it doesn't fundamentally change the highest price, which is the cost of staff, because there's a ratio of like one person essentially maintains 40 or 50, I can't remember the metric, servers. And whether they're virtual servers or physical service, it takes that much time to manage all of the passes and everything else to go in with it. But over time, as you move to a virtual environment, over time, as you move to this physically more efficient environment and a simpler environment, you will inevitably reduce the staff costs associated with that. And you'll also reduce the energy costs associated with operating the inefficient systems. And as you replace the older hardware on a regular basis, you could start taking the benefit of the standardization by lowering the price of the replacement servers. When you're supporting 85 different models of servers, you don't get any volume discounts to speak of out of that. So these are all things that are starting to work together to get us in the right direction. I don't know the cost savings. The short-term cost savings is nil. The longer term, which is 4, 6, 8 years, our consultant is looking at those numbers right now. They've just finished what is the first inventory of state information assets, first comprehensive inventory, and they'll be able to give us some more of that information.
And if I might, just real quickly, if you can explain to me that you're going to do your offset of your agency savings, and I may be a slide ahead here somewhere. I guess I'm up to slide 20, where in fiscal year 11 you talk about your cost less $10 million of agency contributions. Can you explain how you've quantified that, and
sure.
if that's ongoing agency contributions or...
Madam Chair, Representative Holberg, if I may lay the foundation with this, because I think it's important to understand the context. What we're proposing is a leased facility, a private sector or perhaps local government-owned facility that we will lease the amount of space that we need for this data center. We will own all the hardware that runs inside that data center. We will administer all the systems and protect all the information. They will have the facility, the shell of that building. And so that's the context for this whole thing.
What I don't quite understand is how would that... Suppose instead of that, we bonded for it and built our own building. Why would this save money on doing that on the grounds that, you know, when we bond it, instead of lease payments, we're paying debt service for over a period of time?
Madam Chair, I don't know what the numbers are yet. We're trying to get those estimates, working with the Department of Administration on that. But part of what we're trying to do is act quickly, and the process to develop a building like this through the bonding process is typically 4 to 6 years. And we're trying to get in one within a year or two.
It's a 35W bridge, which could be done in, 11 months? You know, I don't think we have to take those answers anymore.
Madam Chair, just operating off past history and how the system has worked. Getting things through the legislature and the bonding committees is often an interesting exercise. So there are a number of variables that we don't control. So we're trying to look at what we can control within the executive thing. Hopefully we'll have those numbers for you in a couple of weeks, certainly before you get to the decision point.
Representative Downey, 1 second.
No.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On slide 18, the proposed management slide, did you in your analysis look at just outsourcing the whole thing, the physical management and the staffing of it?
Madam Chair, we are looking at the entire range of options all the way out to outsourcing everything. We tend to support what we call strategic sourcing, which is we identify the areas where it's not in our benefit to do them financially and just outsourcing those pieces of it. But we're looking at the entire range of options. The consultant that we are using has given us a generalization, not a specific response to our situation, which is that for organizations with our historic cost profiles in our situation, outsourcing is more expensive, significantly more expensive than doing it in-house. Other people may have different situations. This is their general recommendation. We hope to have much more solid information about those options. Managed services or total outsourcing, strategic sourcing to bring to you, but we don't have that information yet.
So this is just a preliminary, excuse me.
This is our best estimate of what is under our control again, what the situation would provide, based on what people that do this for a living have told us. The $16.5 million in the Governor's Initiative does a couple of things. First of all, you don't just pick up 30 data centers and tuck them under your arm and walk down the street to another building. There's an enormous amount of planning that has to go into making sure that the building is properly prepared for them and then managing that migration so that customers don't see an interruption of service when the operation moves from one location to another. And the first year's operating costs for that consolidated data center are included in the budget as best we can estimate them at this point. The closer we get to having final information, the better off we'll be able the better off the information that we'll have for you. The second year, the budget includes the lease cost differential between what the state agencies pay to lease data centers now and what it will cost them to occupy this new data center. That does include that the rent cost for the square footage It does not include the costs that are there foregoing on the space that they have, because we don't yet have all the information on where they are in the life cycle of the lease, if they're in the first year or the last year of the lease, if the space can be, it's called recommissioned, can be turned back into something other than data center space and used for other purposes within the agency, or let's go back to whoever holds the lease on the property. So that piece of it, just to be clear, is not included in this budget. But it does try to take what is currently being spent on leases for data centers, add the marginal amounts for this year, and cover that for the coming biennium. After that, the cost for the lease space, which will be higher than what they pay now, without question, have to be provided for in the rate structure or in their lease payments, again, depending on where they are financially as an agency. And that process, which for state-owned property is administered by the Department of Administration, they will be the manager of all the leases. Now, there's a number of different ways that it may happen. We may act on their behalf, and they pay us through the rate process. They may pay for a square footage allocation. We don't know all the details of how that's going to work. We just know what the overall approach would be. So this is the summary that we were talking about, and I think this was the question that came up earlier. The 11.7 includes planning costs and the first-year operating costs. The fiscal year 11, the $4.8 million, is that incremental lease cost for the higher-priced facility. And you can see down below that that's what the actual data center rent is estimated to be, is $14.8 million a year. And the first half year of that is the $7.4
million. Madam Chair, if I might, Holger, how did you get to the $10 million figure?
Went into MAPS and drew out the lease cost. That information and the information, some of it is within budgets within state agencies that have state space, state-owned space, some of it comes from the lease payments to the private sector.
Yeah.
And it was after the difficulty in calculating this is that most state agencies do not pay data center rates. They pay a blended rate that includes all the different kind of properties they have. Typically, if you go up in most organizations, they'll pay a data center rate that covers the cost of the data center, and then an office rate and a storage rate or something like that. A lot of our leases and a lot of our state property is a blended rate. So we tried to calculate that as best we could based on the amount and the type of space they have for data centers.
And Madam Chair and Mr. Lally, so just so I'm clear, did you include any utility costs, any efficiency costs, any reduced staffing costs, or was it purely a function of the square footage at the best that you could determine lease rate?
Again, it depends on the situation. In some cases, our lease costs, like state agency costs, are separated out. Our primary data center for the state, we pay independently for the cost of energy for that from what's built into the lease. In many facilities where the data center is not such a significant presence in their space, they pay an overall utility rate through the lease. So it's a mix. It's not uniform.
Madam Chair, I guess what I'm trying to get at is not so much for the day-to-day utility cost associated with the square footage, but listening to your presentation, I heard you talk about by consolidating all of this that you should have less cost to run the system, if you will, in a more efficient manner. So I'm wondering, in this $10 million, have you booked any efficiency costs outside of the physical lease cost savings?
Madam Chair, Representative Holberg, I'm sorry. I don't know for sure, so I'll have to find out. I have to go back to the consultants and look at the numbers they came up with.
All right, thank you. Okay.
The startup cost of 4.3, in case you're interested, this is the breakdown of the planning money and the migration money and what we call risk mitigation, which is to make it so we don't shoot ourselves in the foot moving these servers from place to place. That's the startup cost, the one-time cost that we'll incur for migrating to the data centers. And if you have questions about any of that. And if you have any other questions about the data center.
Madam Chair, if I might, I'm struggling with this issue and how to pay for it. And I see at various places through your presentation, you talk about cost savings. And state government finances a little committee with a little budget compared to the rest mm-hmm. of the budget. And so what I'm trying to get at is there a way that we can present information that we can charge back as a percentage of the state budget for each funding area, or some way that we can show, I mean, for you to say that you know, you're going to get to recoup $10 million, I'm wondering how you're going to arm wrestle it out of education and human services and how they're going to cop up $10 million. So I'm sitting here scratching my head thinking that there may be some need and or possibility of putting more structure into the development of this program through some kind of financing plan or scheme, in other words, that we would charge for your service, if you will, at some rate or percentage of budget. So I think it's, we need some kind of justification here of the savings. But so as you're putting together information, you just keep maybe that as an alternative funding thing, and maybe the governor wouldn't support it, but we're going to have to, I think, get creative as a committee in order to elbow our way at the table and get enough of a piece of the pie to get this kind of money relative to the total amount of money that this funding committee usually gets.
And Chair, I should refer this to our CFO who's in the audience, but if we handle this bill back through our rate system, then it doesn't come out of your committee budget targets. It comes out of the agency budget, wherever they may have been created and wherever the money may originate, which would be ideal from everybody's standpoint. My assumption is operating costs in the out years, that's the way it'll happen. But the initial costs right now, we have no way to tap those. Larry,
Madam Chair, there may be a way to get the $16 million through some type of formula as well, and I guess that's what I'm, you know, no way have a clear path to that end, but any information that you would give to help kind of justify how that might be able to be accomplished may be helpful in the end game of the session.
Okay, I found you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So as you think about that, have you actually modeled, or is that part of the next phase of the consultants' activity, what the actual cost savings would be to the end user departments here? I mean, I assume we have some kind of financial benefit to present to them, whether it's a short-term or long-term. This has to be in their best term or best interest, both financially and in terms of their own risk management and operational budget.
Madam Chair, Representative Downey, I've not seen a model yet, a comprehensive model, but I'm guessing, given the cost of operating the new data center, you will not see a net savings. What you will see is increased value through the reliability and the disaster recovery capability of being in a better state. But there's no question, it's going to cost them more per square foot. Once we've reached the position of the consolidation and the virtualization, the square footage that they have dedicated to them will be less, but the cost more per square foot that will be reflected in their rates. Now, if agencies are able to migrate out of the space that they're currently leasing and convert it to other spaces or something like that, that represents that offset that we hope will happen, but not in every case will that take place, or at least not within the immediate year. You can't go into the middle of the revenue department and create a Starbucks space out of their former data center. So, I mean, those are the realities, and we don't have a handle on all of those yet.
I'm struggling with that because I got to assume that the vast majority of the expense that they're incurring is in the people to manage. I mean, the space is like, it's got to be nothing relative to the cost of the servers and the software license and the support and all of that, right? I mean, those things get off outsourced in their terms to you at the data center, right?
Madam Chair, Representative Downey, I'm a little hazy on the numbers, so please take this with a grain of salt. We can probably validate it. There are about 1,600 IT, 1,500 or 1,800 IT employees in the executive branch exclusive of MinQ. I believe there's about 60 of them that are involved in data center operations, and a significant number of those are within OET running the state's major data center. So it's not going to be an industrial revolution type labor-saving initiative. This is about security and reliability and quality, not about being able to reduce headcount. It won't be there. Most of the staff are involved in application management, not data center management.
But if we make the app, when we get through this, shouldn't the application management be simpler? And shouldn't that have some effect on how many people need to do it?
Madam Chair, I haven't thought that through. I think the situation when we're talking about application management and we're talking about developing applications and operating them, the skill sets are not exactly interchangeable. Database analyst and systems programmer are not necessarily going to be interchangeable with the people that manage servers. So you won't necessarily be able to leverage that staff the way you might like to. I don't know that we can say that we'll be able to simplify until we get to a point of having more enterprise-wide applications that have a reduced agency profile. But I don't know that for sure. I don't want to mislead you.
Okay.
Madam Chair,
we knock it up. Just obviously, looking at the time and the speed that we go, we're not going to get to start. We figured we shouldn't even start enterprise electronic licensing. But looking at our schedule, we may have to fit another meeting in sometime. So stay tuned.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to Representative Holberg. If this is about, which I think makes a lot of sense, this is about security and the value that you're providing through the data center, rather than just a straight cost saving. Wouldn't the funding kind of scheme, as Representative Holberg mentioned, be granting authority to OET to require a certain percentage of an operating budget of an agency be dedicated to a high quality data backbone or something like that, and then allows, essentially give a certain amount of authority to pay for this by requiring agencies to spend a certain percentage of their operating budgets on the kind of shared service projects this is?
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, that's what our rate system is essentially set up to do, so that they pay a market value price for the services we provide to them, whether that's data center or storage or bandwidth or whatever it might happen to be. So we don't have to, through the rate structure, we can go through and identify what capacity they're using of the shared space, and they get billed back for it. That's the foundation for 92% of our budget.
Madam Chair, Mr. Lally, couldn't we do that on the upfront side too, with just some additional authority?
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, I'm not sure the authority doesn't exist there. If we get the implementation mechanism down, but part of it is it's hard to predict going forward what the direction is going to be in some of that, and it's easier to do it reasonably on a rate-based system than on a budget-based system, because once we have the appropriation, because that money that pays those rates comes from federal funding, it comes from state agency appropriations, it comes from fees and charges that the agencies have for different applications that they run. I'm not sure that we can look for a direct payment or direct authority over those funds. The federal funds particularly are problematic. I don't know enough about it, so I'm not that attuned to the financial management aspect of it. But we could try to find out what those alternatives might provide us is along the lines of Representative Holbrook was talking about.
I'm sure if I might, kind of along that line, and I'm trying to wrap my brain around this, and I kind of off of what Representative Winkler was saying. In a model where if we say that this money that you're asking for in this budget now is is it, do you view it as like startup costs, and that once you get the central data center and you get the agencies bought into the idea and signed up and working with you, that the rate that they would pay you would then anticipate costs of refreshing the system, upgrading hardware, you know, maintenance, etc., so that this one-time or two- or three-year appropriation that you're asking for then would kind of get you up and going, and that we wouldn't expect to see OET back here for the cost of maintaining and upgrading the data center moving out 5, 10, 15 years?
Typically, the rate system builds in the life cycle cost. That's why it follows through here. If your refresh of hardware, for example, is I'm sorry, I can't remember the term, but it's spread out over the expected life of that asset, you can provide in your rate structure for recovery of that cost and put it away and replace it as time comes.
No, and I understand that. I'm just asking, is that the intent of your agency? That you would do that.
Yes.
So, I'm just trying to figure out, you're asking for this money for how many years are you going to be asking for pots of money like this, and at what point? And then, because it sounds like you haven't used all the tools in 16E, at least by some people's evaluation. Will you have very long-term contracts with these agencies so you can anticipate those costs and plan for it? Or are you going to be in a situation where you invest in the data center, and if you get a new commissioner of human services and education and they don't think you're as wonderful as all of us do, they decide they're taking a hike and they're leaving the central data center and they're going to go back to their own model. Have you planned for that possibility?
Chair Representative Holberg, this is a governor's initiative, and we would assume that the agencies would follow the governor's lead in this.
New governor 10 years from now?
I don't speculate on things like that. There is clearly some risk with a leased facility, because if down the road a vendor goes out of business or is purchased or something else happens, there is some exposure for us, and then we'd have to go through this process again. But that's where the crafting of the service level agreement with the vendor becomes really critical, to make sure that our costs are covered in a situation like that. Clearly, this is not a pleasant experience, I'm sorry, coming and asking the legislature for hundreds of millions of dollars. So we would like not to have to do that again.
I think it's a pleasant experience for us trying to go to, well,
I've been around for long. I don't.
As I was talking to my good friend, the majority leader in the Senate, and I was explaining all of this, and he would say, yes, and you're going to wreck the savings that you get in a particular subject from a particular person. I won't put the names in. You can all figure it out. And he looks very glum about the prospect. Anyway, Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I know we're right at the end of our time. I'll just go real quick. But I think, Representative Holberg, you did bring up a point and an issue here, that when state law mandates that in those biennial fundings, all funds must be extended and cannot be carried forward. In this area where you have some of these kinds of investments like that, that's the problem, because they have to extend those and can't store them up, so that in the future, when they have, you know, saving up for a bigger project that you can't do in a biennium, that you need to gather those funds and save for that. Our current financing structure does not allow for that. And it's a real hindrance to just those things that have been talked about here. We can maybe look at that another time.
Okay. Oh, we have Representative Mason moves the minutes of the meeting. Okay. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Adopted. Okay. Any other? We're obviously going to be continuing. Well, you're going to be back for e-licensing at some point, and we're obviously going to be continuing this discussion, and I think some of it's going to be also held in terms of what direction we're going privately to see if we can get a better direction. So, Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You want to say something? Anyone wants to say something before we're about to adjourn?
Go Edina.
What?
Go Edina.
Okay. You guys, okay, meeting adjourned.